who swallow truth. Hollow, shallow, ball of cute. A white shit they in high pursuit. Clones on phones, slipped out drones. Never made they wrong. I know to make they wealth, they'll break they self. All paper, stand for paper, music capers. Love they haters, desire to jealous. Body lovers, crying fronters, lies and cover up. Self-promoters, slippery slopers, speculate. Hella hate, be full steady eye.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and joining me now is Tim Dickinson, who is the National Affairs Correspondent at Rolling Stone magazine and blogs at Rolling Stone. He has a special article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, How the GOP Became the Party of the Rich. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Dickinson. And the article really is a very lengthy examination of this evolution of the party of Lincoln into the party of the Koch brothers. And the party of the 1%, how do they get away with it? I mean, they're only, if you're talking about the 1%, if we had a real democracy, there'd be no way in the world that a party that represents only 1% of the people could ever get elected.
As some academics, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, describe it in their book, Winner Take All Politics, that the GOP is very good at serving up what they call horse and rabbit stew. So there are certain little sweeteners in there that, the child tax credit and various other, gestures which are meaningful in people's lives, but pale in comparison. There's turned out to be dimes on the dollar or pennies on the dollar, really, for the kinds of benefits that are going to the very top. And so the GOP has been sort of very adroit at providing, marginal benefits for people who are really desperate for them, while larding the very top of the income spectrum with very special tax favors.
You quote here David Stockman, who, of course, we remember from the Reagan days when he went behind the woodshed for telling the truth, that the Republican Party has totally abdicated its job in our democracy. Then he goes on to say they're on this anti-tax jihad, one that benefits the prosperous class. Then he also refers to Grover Norquist as a anti-tax terrorist. I mean, why is it that this fellow, Grover Norquist, has unprecedented power?
Starting in about 1995, when Reagan was pushing through the last major overhaul of the tax code, Grover Norquist and Americans, I'm forgetting the name of his group momentarily. I'm having a Rick Perry moment. But anyhow, his anti-tax group was set up to prevent backsliding on the reforms of the 1986 bill and to push it forward over the finish line. And so Grover Norquist has had since then this anti-tax pledge, which is generally understood as just having just being against taxes, but it also prohibits GOP politicians, people who sign it, from closing any tax loopholes to pay for anything except for new tax cuts. And this made a modicum of sense following the cleaning up of the tax code. There weren't very many loopholes and new rates had been set, and it sort of made sense in a certain degree to say, this, we're the GOP and we're going to protect our accomplishment here. But it's become, in many respects, vicious tool for protecting what have become tax favors built into the tax code over the last few decades, and so that now you have yacht owners deducting the interest on their boat large enough to have a bathroom, and millionaires with luxury homes who get to deduct that from their taxes, and yet when the GOP is running around saying America is broke and we need to cut the benefits of people who need support, heating their homes in the winter, and child nutrition funding, and all that is on the chopping block. But because of this pledge, no one can touch, these obvious distortions of the tax code that benefit the super wealthy, unless that somehow goes to lowering somebody else's tax rate. It's sort of preposterous. And honest Republicans, people like Alan Simpson, have said as much.
It's still a mystery, Tim Dickinson, how this obscure lobbyist, by the way, he's both a lobbyist and a head of Americans for Tax Reform. He's sort of the den mother for all of these young conservative activists. He has a salon that apparently is the hot ticket amongst the aspiring right-wing activists. He's been described as Liberace with a wife. I mean, the New York Times has been writing up editorials recently about how his power is being diminished and how a few brave Republicans are stepping up and renouncing the pledge. But it feels like, you know, McCarthy and J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, I mean, the crux of Norquist's power, there's sort of two different things. He holds this Wednesday salon, this Wednesday meeting that sort of convenes the grassroots activist segments of the GOP and puts them in contact with policymakers and lobbyists, and they try and sort of set GOP policies. So he stands astride of this meeting of the establishment and the grassroots, and that gives him sort of tremendous power, because the single issue that is the glue to all that is this anti-tax policy. And so if you mess with Grover Norquist, you're essentially messing with the vast right-wing conspiracy that there are a lot of people who can punish you, and if you go back on this tax pledge, you're going to get primaried, and that primary opponent's going to be very well funded. And so everyone in the GOP, I think, understands that. I mean, we're at one of these moments now with the super committee where push is coming to shove, and people are starting to question whether they need to put the country ahead of this pledge. And I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But I don't think for the murmurs that you're hearing about some discontent with the pledge, that you're actually seeing people who are sticking their necks out and saying, you know, I will vote for raising revenue.
Well, clearly, what happened to George H.W. Bush, read my lips, no new taxes, and when he was forced to deal with reality and raise taxes, he lost the election to Clinton, as we all know. Conservatives took that as a lesson. It may not be an accurate one, because there was this fellow Ross Perot who split the vote in. Took 20 million votes, arguably, away from the Republicans. But nevertheless, that has been, I take it, that's what's been keeping them in line in terms of sticking with Norquist's pledge.
Right. I mean, it's sort of a self-serving narrative on Norquist's part. But certainly he says, you know, that was sort of the pivotal moment. He distinguished himself from Bob Dole and won the nomination in 1988 by signing the pledge, and then made it the centerpiece of his general election campaign against Dukakis. And then when he reversed himself and raised taxes, that certainly in the Norquist narrative created the running room for a candidate like Ross Perot to stand up and say, I'm something different. You know, you can trust me, you can't trust him. But I think that really is sort of where the pledge went from, you know, Norquist himself likens it to bottling, I'll respect you in the morning. You know, this is one of the great, most frequently broken pledges in politics, I won't raise your taxes, and suddenly it's become sort of a blood oath, and it's something that you break only if you're prepared to sacrifice your office. And I think the other thing to understand, too, is that Norquist has taken sort of a minor league baseball approach to all of this, where he has taken the pledge to state legislatures, and politicians like Eric Cantor, who come up through this you know, state houses, in Cantor's case, he signed this pledge when he was a member of the Virginia House of Delegates, and now has come to Washington and leads, you know, all these Tea Party freshmen, who many of whom did the same thing. So this is now sort of core to the Republican brand, as it were.
Well, you mentioned Tim Dickinson again. Tim Dickinson is the national affairs correspondent at Rolling Stone magazine. He blogs at rollingstone.com, and he has a special report in the current issue of Rolling Stone, how the GOP became the party of the rich. You mentioned the super committee. There are increasing reports that indicate that it may be deadlocked. And, of course, if it's deadlocked, then these mandatory cuts come in. So you'd think there's an incentive for them to pass something out of the committee. But the reason it's deadlocked, I'm told, is because the Republicans will not budge on tax breaks for the rich. I mean, again, this is a line in the sand that they've drawn. And it just, I find it astounding that the American people put up with it, unless, you know, we're all hopelessly in the thrall of millionaires and billionaires. And, you know, we are so conditioned to believe that we're all going to win the lottery. I just don't believe that that is the way the American people are.
You know, it's perplexing, and I don't think that most people sort of understand the extent to which there are opportunities to raise revenue without raising taxes. And so that if you close some of these tax favors, these things that are sort of off the table because of the second part of Norquist Pledge, some of these things are bread and butter, you know, the mortgage interest deduction, but some of them are just simple accounting rules for oil companies and others that just create these absurd market distorting pressures that in normal times, in sort of a normal conversation, conservatives worried about fiscal discipline and about free markets would be very much against. Just to give you understanding this, if you take all the favoritism, all the different ways that money is dispersed or not collected essentially through the tax code, that amount of revenue is actually greater than the amount of revenue that's collected from income taxes. So this is, we're talking about $1.2 trillion a year that Treasury forgoes because of special tax favors. And so there's more than enough money there to go after, you know, to solve this entire phony debt crisis. I mean, we have a real problem with our debt, but we're not broke. There's a chance, tremendous opportunities to raise revenue in ways that probably correct distortions in the market and might you know, have our economy working better afterward. And so this is a crisis that has been essentially foisted on the American public by the Republican Party. And the obvious solution of closing some of these tax loopholes has been put off the table because of this a pledge that, you know, some Republicans, former Republicans like George Voinovich, say is a, you know, violation of a politician's oath of office. If you sign this pledge, you're putting that before your loyalty and adherence to the Constitution and your constituencies.
Well, Tim Dickinson, as your article points out in the current issue of Rolling Stone, how the GOP became the party of the rich. In the last few decades, the annual income of the 400 richest Americans has more than tripled, while their share of the tax burden has plunged by 40%. And if you go back to Eisenhower, the richest Americans were taxed at 92%. Then under Kennedy, it would drop down to 70%. Under Reagan, it dropped down to 50%. And under George W. Bush, it dropped down to, what, about 30%.
35%,
right.
The traditional narrative sort of takes this, you know, at sort of 1979, 1980, and the tax revolt that Reagan led, and the Trojan horse that led to an across-the-board cut in marginal tax rates. And I think that's certainly that's true. And I think what my article tries to tease out, though, is that there's some subtlety that misses, and that, you know, when Reagan pushed through that tax cut, there was this hope that there would also be, you know, spending cuts along with that, that the budget would remain largely in balance, and that the sort of voodoo economics would create a lot of growth, and that would keep the budget situation from getting out of hand. And almost immediately after they passed that tax cut, deficits, you know, the spending cuts didn't materialize. Deficits started to spike out of control, and it was Bob Dole, fellow Republican, who led the effort to increase taxes in 1982, and for the rest of his term, Reagan was quite a tax increaser in sort of the traditional Republican mold of let's keep our books in balance. And Reagan actually raised taxes on capital gains as part of his tax reform so that they were in line with his lowered marginal tax rates. But what happened in 1997 is that Republicans, led by Newt Gingrich, decoupled that again, and so they took capital gains from 28% down to just 20%, and that just gives a huge huge benefit to the investor class. And this, we're talking about, I think, about 2/3 of that benefit went directly to the 1%. And from there on, you know, Bush had an across-the-board tax cut, but then in 2003 lowered the capital gains rate again to 15%. And so there's some underlying factors that have led to income inequality in this country, but the tax policy has worked to exacerbate that. So that at the very time that the richest Americans are getting richer, the tax policy is working to help them get richer still. And it seems clear that that's a return on investment from these rich people investing in Washington.
Well, Tim Dickinson, you quote Bruce Bartlett, the architect of Reagan's 1981 tax cut, in your article, saying that taxes are ridiculously low, which anybody that's ever been in any other country on the planet knows that the U.S. has got the lowest taxes of all. In Europe, they have VAT taxes, et cetera, along with, you know, steep income taxes, and pretty much every other social democracy has, you know, considerably greater taxes. But, of course, you do get government services in return. When you have the Michelle Bachmanns of the world in the debates talking about how people shouldn't, if they don't work, they shouldn't be fed. She's on this jihad against food stamps. She's also all the time talking about how we're taxed, we're taxed, we're taxed. I think the American people actually believe it. I know you're, if anybody reads your article, they get disabused of it. But what do you think the impasse there is in terms of educating the American people to recognize how little comparatively they're taxed?
The problem truly is, I think, that we're not taxing our elites. We don't sort of have this political system that is competent enough to tax people at the top. I mean, that, you know, there are, you could make the argument that taxes should be higher overall, but the fact that people who are, you know, the top 400 income earners are paying an effective tax rate that's 5% lower than a single average worker is just, you know, outlandish on its face. And so, you know, at the same time that Michelle Bachmann is saying that everyone in the country should have to pay something in tax, you know, and it used to be a Republican talking point that it was a good thing that, you know, Ronald Reagan and others had helped free people at the low income levels from the burden of the of federal income taxes. That used to be something that Republicans celebrated. Now they target the whatever percent they say don't pay any income tax. But at the same time that Michelle Bachmann is saying that, she wants to do away with capital gains taxes, which would sort of have the perverse effect of kicking, I think it's something like 25,000 millionaires off the tax rolls entirely. It's people who, like Mitt Romney, make money for money. And so in this, this is a Tea Party darling. You know, there's a real disconnect here that a woman who holds herself out as a champion of, the little guy is, in fact, advocating a tax policy that would let tens of thousands of millionaires pay no tax and then pay no tax again when that income is passed on to the heirs.
You also quote David K. Johnston, who's, I think, one of the leading experts on taxes, and particularly how the social engineering aspect of taxes and how deeply they affect the nation and how it evolves. And I think it's pretty clear that the rich have gotten away with an extraordinary robbery, if you will, this Robin Hood in reverse trend that's been going on for so long. And that's what leaves you sort of scratching your head, trying to figure out, one, how they've gotten away with it. And does it come down to the fact, Tim Dickinson, that money has transcended votes in our electoral system? Because if you create a political system that's based on money and the person with the most money wins, then that would suggest that the richest people will end up owning the system.
Well, I mean, the way that Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, put it to me is that, you know, rich people now get a better return from investing in Washington than they do from investing in new products or new factories or R&D or the rest of it. And so if you can make money with money, and the best return on investment that you can get is lobbying politicians in Washington to lower your tax rate, well, there's sort of a rational incentive to do that. I think that's the danger of that is only accelerated in this post-Citizens United world where the cap on donations is gone now. Problematically, you have the people like Chuck Schumer in the Democratic Party who are, you know, ably defending the interests of their money constituents. And so there's spillover here. There are, you know, sort of key Democratic enablers who contribute to this trend that I've been writing about here. But certainly the impetus You look at where we are. You have people on the streets who are crying income inequality, and you have politicians from Herman Cain to Rick Perry to Newt Gingrich who are proposing a flat tax, which essentially would raise taxes on the poor and the middle class to pay for massive new tax cuts for the top 1% for millionaires. And so it's a strange world we live in where, you know, especially these people are standing as somehow defenders of the little guy against the abuses of the system.
Well, we started out the program today, Tim Dickinson, talking about the 60 Minutes report on how the Congress has created a unique privilege unto themselves that exempts them from insider trading. And that this is quite pervasive, that, you know, members of Congress who get special information about how a bill is going to be passed and what's in the bill and who will win and who will lose from the bill are able to short the market and do insider trading that would put any ordinary person in jail or even a Wall Street banker in jail. And that suggests to me, in the context of what we're talking about, is that, you know, that maybe the billionaires, they're total whores and hirelings of the billionaires. And this is some crumbs under the table for them.
I confess to not having seen the 60 Minutes program, but although I've been reading bits and pieces about it. But it, I think that we have a pervasively rotten system, and I think Americans are waking up to that. And I think you'll see that in the record low approval ratings of Congress and the rest of it. And so, we need some fundamental reforms to protect the interests of the 99%.
Well, just in closing, Tim Dickinson, it's still very puzzling for me to try and figure out how this has happened and how this has happened so inexorably. And that's what your article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, How the GOP Became the Party of the Rich, it's a lengthy treatise on the history of how we've come to be where we are. But essentially, I guess it's about how our democracy has sort of transgressed into a kind of oligarchy, and our economy has become a plutonomy. And the question you keep asking yourself is, well, you know, this is so at odds with the mythology of an egalitarian society, a meritocracy. Americans see themselves as the American dream, which is anchored in the middle class. And yet that is a cruel joke in today's context. Just two questions that come out of that. One is, why would anybody want to destroy the middle class? And two, what do you think will happen? What do you think will wake up the middle class and return America to its mythology that has been so disgraced?
Well, I mean, if you look at sort of the intellectual arguments of the people who are leading this charge, the Grover Norquist of the world, they see progressive taxation as a form of theft and sort of embrace radical notions of Ayn Rand and others, that greed is fundamentally moral and that people acting in their self-interest should be rewarded to whatever degree is feasible. And so that, I confronted Grover Norquist on this precisely. I said, do you have any moral qualms about, what you're doing? That people who need government services are robbed of them, and people who, don't want for anything in the world are lavished with these favors. And he said, I understand, greed, and I understand, envy, but, essentially progressive taxation has no moral component, that it's simply a form of theft. That's sort of the radical ideology that underlies all of this. And I'm sorry, I've lost track of your question.
Well, the second question is, do you think there's a way for people to sort of wake up and want to restore, want to bring the mythology into line with the reality? In other words, a wake up, basically say, the middle class is endangered. Can we bring back America?
I think if you look for what unites the Tea Party and the Occupy movement, both of them seem to be populated by people who have worked hard and played by the rules and found themselves not getting ahead. And I think you see a lot of anger that isn't sort of necessarily well-directed. But I think both on the right and the left, you see members of the middle class standing up, being outraged and saying, this system isn't working for us. And I think if you can, if there is a moment of awakening that the interests of exposes those disparate movements are not, you know, oppositional, but in fact lead to some of the same conclusions about needing to reform the system so that it works on behalf of the little guy again, I think that then you will have you know, some real opportunities for change, because I think even a political system that's as captured as ours, you know, needs to be responsive to the electorate. And if the electorate really starts to get it, then I think some of these practices, some of this, you know, policy that favors the 1% so grotesquely is in danger.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Tim Dickinson.
I appreciate your interest. Thank you.
And I've been speaking with Tim Dickinson, who is the Rolling Stone reporter responsible for the article, How the GOP Became the Party of the Rich. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank Graham Fitzgibbon, the producer. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30.